in a world full of straight people. Aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
Dave,
yes.
Very exciting episode today. We are joined by the creator of a show called The Flight Attendant and the showrunner and executive producer of the new Netflix series Dead Boy Detectives, which premieres on April 25th. And he's also writing Star Trek IV and A Simple Favor 2. He's apparently opening a play right now. I don't even know how he has time to speak to us, but Steve Yockey is here.
Steve, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm very happy to be here.
How's your eclipse morning going?
It's going fine, I guess. I don't think it's going to be super visible here. Everyone says it's going to be too cloudy, and I think we're geographically in the wrong place, but everyone seems excited about it.
Okay. We've just got sort of a strange light outside. No, not really. I did look directly at it like you're supposed to do. But it's, it's like there's a strange filter over the sunlight right now. And that's about it.
You didn't build your little cardboard camera obscura box so that you could like.
I didn't. I didn't like poke a hole through a shoebox with a, you know, whatever, pin.
Yeah.
I didn't do any of it. Too lazy. Matt, did you?
No, saw nothing, felt nothing. Yeah, it's. I don't think it's a terribly exciting event in LA. I mean, no. To quote our friend Deanna Chang, it's a shadow, grow up. That was her response to Eclipse Mania. It does feel like it is. I don't remember it being like just talked about this much.
Yeah, it is. We do seem to be gripped in Eclipse Mania. I think it's like Taylor Swift. We're so desperate for a shared experience that it's just like, yeah, we'll do this one.
Matt, did this conversation though, Matt, you just gave me the title for my memoir, which is going to be Saw Nothing, Felt Nothing.
Saw Nothing, Felt Nothing. Grow.
I find that Steve very hard to believe that would be an accurate title based on your life. Where did you grow up?
In Atlanta. Atlanta, Georgia, born and raised.
And who were you in high school? Like, what was your social scene? What were your pop culture interests?
I don't know. I guess I was just kind of a mid-tier guy in high school. I don't know. I just kind of blended. I was in the marching band.
Oh, what'd you play?
I played bass clarinet and tenor saxophone, and then I was the drum major eventually. My dad has a motto, which is it's better to be the leader of something than a follower. And that's a hard thing to grow up with when, you know, you're a teenager trying to figure your life out. So whatever, we got here. Everything's fine.
So in the middle of making 40% of the world's entertainment, are you watching? What are you watching at the moment?
I've been rewatching a lot of classic movies lately. Like I just watched Double Indemnity again, which I'm obsessed with. Show wise, I've been kind of, because I've been doing so much scripted work, I've mostly been binging a lot of The Traitors on Peacock, like all the different versions of The Traitors from like the UK, the Australia version. They just dropped a New Zealand version, which is, that kind of stuff fascinates me. Like gamesmanship on that level fascinates me. Yeah. And also I've just been traveling so much that I haven't really gotten to, I need to catch up on many, many shows.
Who doesn't?
There's a lot out there.
It's much too long.
Do you feel like you would be a good player on The Traitors? Do you feel like you'd be a good traitor if you had to be a traitor?
No, I'm one of those people that would that thinks they would be a good trader, and then once I was on the show and got picked, I would immediately start to spiral that everything, like through self-analysis, like overanalyze everything decision that I made, and it would be real obvious. I think it'd be real obvious that I'm a trader. Dave? I'd still like to go on.
Oh yeah, same. Dave, how would you do?
You know, I haven't seen it, so I can't really speak to it. But if there's strategy involved, that would be very mafia. Bad.
It's mafia, okay. Yeah, it's
mafia, right?
Okay. Okay,
so a werewolf.
I see. Yeah, no, I'd probably be terrible. Strategically, I'm very bad. I tried to learn how to play chess over the lockdown, and I found that I'm a very stupid person. So no, I think I would not be good. Maybe Amazing Race, but I feel like a traitor's is beyond me.
Amazing Race just seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, there's tasks. Little tasks that you got to do along the way. I can get
I watch those. I watch all those reality shows and I think like Amazing Race or Survivor or whatever. And I think, oh, this would be fun. And then the first time they have to like swim across something or climb something or talk to someone who doesn't speak English, I'm like, oh no, I would not this.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah. I'm in a Survivor fantasy league and I'll tell you a secret. I'm winning and I haven't watched a single episode this whole season. I just went on the app when we like did our draft and just picked people based on their pictures, based who I liked vibes. And I'm winning. I haven't watched because I can't. I really struggle with Jeff, but just his like gym coach energy. But yeah, when I do watch, it gives me so much anxiety because I'm like, I would be out on day one. I couldn't handle the subterfuge. I definitely couldn't handle the physical suffering, the lack of coffee, any of it.
I can't. Did you guys, I don't know if you saw, there was one season where Mike White was on Survivor, went all the way to the end. I was like, more power to him. That's crazy.
Yeah. Big Brother worries me. Just the idea of it. I tried it once. And it was like the first episode and everyone was packing their bags at home saying like, I'm going to show up there and lie. And it's like, well, what a weird thing to say, first of all. And then it just, that is one that I keep hoping someday will grab me, but it hasn't.
Do you know what's really fascinating about shows like Big Brother is when something in the world happens that the people on the show have no idea and they have to like update them. Or they bring everybody in and have like a meeting or something. So it happened after the 2016 election. They told them, you know, who won the election and everything. So it's that's when the show gets kind of fascinating to me. But when it's just the lying, I just get mad at.
You have, I hope, seen the UK Celebrity Big Brother clip where I think it's New York is in the house.
Oh, and, yeah, of course.
And Angela Bowie. I've seen that. Yeah. Angela, do you know what
about
I'm talking
the
about?
Shoes, returning the shoes.
No, this is about David dying.
Oh, wait, what?
Okay, so Angela, ex-wife of David Bowie, goes into where New York is and says, David died. And New York thinks it's David Guest who is staying in the house. So she thinks their housemate David Guest has died. And then she tells everyone, you guys, David Guest died. And they're all like, what? Hold on. And everybody loses their mind. And then they find David Guest and he was like, no, I was just sleeping. You guys, like, I'm not dead. And then Angela Bowie has to be like, no, David Bowie died. I didn't think I would have to say both names.
I didn't think I would have to clarify that for you. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's fascinating. I thought you were talking about the clip that all gay men know, which is the clip where she just, talks about someone lied to her several times and told her that she was fly and hot.
Oh,
she's
my
none of those
God.
Things. Have you heard that clip where she like,
no,
this is okay, Tiffany Pollard we're talking about, right?
Yeah. New York. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is a monologue that feels like it was written by someone, but it very clearly is just coming out of her head, but it's amazing. And they show clips of it in gay bars. It's iconic.
John Hill has a ballad that he wrote, or I mean, he didn't write, he used those lyrics and turned it into a beautiful ballad that's on his Instagram. It's very powerful.
Wow. Okay. Well,
she is the funniest person alive. Steve, I have a question. So working on the flight attendant, how did that experience affect your relationship to air travel?
Well, I certainly don't tell flight attendants that I created the show for flight attendant. I don't want to roll those dice. I do think it makes me much more appreciative of flight attendants than I used to be, because of the amount of research that went into it, just in terms of, like, you know, finding out that a Diet Coke is the worst thing that you can order on a plane because it takes forever for that particular drink, for the fizz to go down, and it infuriates the flight attendants. Like, these little things that you wouldn't even think about, but mostly it gave me a more of appreciation for the fact that they're there for your safety. Like, really and truly, they're there for your safety, and the yeah. hospitality part of it is the dressing up of it. Yeah. I wish I could tell you that it, like, you know, radically changed my experience of flying, but it's just mostly, it's not something that I would expect to find on the in-flight menu of shows that you can watch. Although apparently you can watch it on some routes. I don't know, but it doesn't seem like you'd want to watch that kind of show on a plane.
No. Has stuff just flying off of planes radically changed your attitude and
yes, approach like to when flying? Doors yeah. just fly out. Yeah. Those doors videos are coming amazing. Off now.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
I saw a video
just
last
happened
night
again. Just happened
well,
again.
Well, there was a Korean Air flight where, well, the best thing is that it keeps happening and the company keeps being like, we're working on it. That doesn't, right? That doesn't help you. But I just saw a video last night. That's probably an older video that is someone just opened a door on a Korean Air flight. Like, a guy would just open the door like he was going to leave the plane nope. as it was landing. And so it's all the people, like, strapped in, like, with the wind blowing in from outside and everything, and someone decided to videotape it. I was like, this is insane. People are crazy.
God almighty. We're lucky to be alive. I mean, it's like we're on a razor's edge at all times.
Well, I'm on a bunch of flights right now, like, traveling yeah. quite a bit. So I do think about it. Although I definitely think about it. I didn't used to imagine the door just randomly flying off, or a window, like a hole opening in the side of a plane. I now do think about that.
Mm-hmm. Hard not to.
And then I think there's nothing I can do about it. So,
yeah. Yeah. That's a good Zen approach. What did you grow up watching? What were your foundational shows and movies?
When I was little kid, every Friday night, I was allowed to stay up late and I watched Dallas with my parents, which is not a show that a little kid should watch. And I was obsessed with alcoholic supreme Sue Ellen Ewing, who
the best
defined the broken woman stereotype for me for till now, and probably shaped the fact that I really, really like to write complicated women, and I'm not deeply concerned with likability. That's not a fun term. And then when I was a teenager, I watched Twin Peaks. And that, to me, I think shaped those two shows, Dallas and Twin Peaks. If you put them together, that pretty much sums up what I do.
That's you. I loved Dallas. That was the only thing that my parents and I could connect on. It's I see shades of Sue Ellen in The Flight Attendant, you know?
I mean, I think there's shades of Sue Ellen in everything that I've ever written, quite frankly. It was really a defining character for me.
Did you stay up for Falcon Crest, by the way?
No, the other ones didn't get me, like Dynasty and Falcon Crest. It was like I wasn't attracted so much to that opulence. There was something about Dallas, because, you know, it's that weird Texas version of money that just I don't know, that got me. Although as an adult now, I can watch every cat fight from Dynasty and be like, I missed out on so much, because those cat fights are knockdown, drag out in a way that we don't have on television anymore.
It's so good.
Brilliant. It's all on Pluto. You can, like, pick up Dynasty at any time and just go to town. And I speak from recent experience. It's worth it.
Yeah, we were just talking about this because we had a guest on who not only hadn't seen Dynasty, didn't know what Dynasty was.
Yeah.
Not even the sort of CW reboot of Dynasty? That wasn't...
Apparently not.
Wow. That's,
yeah, Dave educated them, gently. Thankfully. I've only gotten to see the first two episodes of Dead Boy Detectives, which I loved, and we're going to talk about. I've seen the Sue Ellen of Dead Boy Detectives yet, but I look forward to her. But
you've
for
seen
people
her.
Who haven't, I've seen her.
The witch.
Of course. What am I talking about? She's right there. So for people who haven't seen it yet, it's based on the beloved comic series by Neil Gaiman. It's a story of two boys who are ghosts who solve paranormal mysteries. But before we get into the show, I have to ask if you believe in ghosts, have had any brush with the paranormal, any shred of any experience in that realm, I'll take it.
As no one's asked me that before ever. That's nice. I think that I don't believe in ghosts like in a way that where I've had experiences with them, but I do believe that there are things that happen in the world that we still don't have the capacity to understand. So I believe weird things are happening, and I'll stop there. That sounded almost like I was going to go into a QAnon pitch. I didn't like that. Wasn't my intent. I apologize.
Well, that is the trouble with, because I'm so interested in the paranormal, especially when you get into sort of nerdy UAP UFO things, but there's such a fine line between that stuff and like QAnon-y sort of conservative conspiracy theory land that, you know, you got to walk a fine line, or I do anyway. So episode one of Dead Boy Detectives, by the way, directed by the great Lee Tolan Krieger, who I know and is a real sweetie pie and so talented. It's a real dream team. When this was brought your way, or however it came to be when you were developing it, I mean, I know Neil Gaiman is an executive producer, so I'm assuming there's some degree of collaboration with him, but what was important for you in terms of, okay, here's where what has to change just by, you know, the nature of this being a TV series, and here's where I want to remain faithful to the source material. How did you like think about that?
I mean, the things that I felt like were really, really important is I discovered this comic book at a point in my young life where I had, as a young adult, I had lost someone very recently. And so there was just something about it that, I mean, it feels like an acid trip when you read it, like it you know, it's very surreal, the comic book, even the way it looks on the page. And I was just hooked on it. I found something in it. And so I approached Warner Brothers while I was working on Flight Attendant. And I was like, hey, you've got this piece of IP. It's like hiding in the back on a shelf somewhere. I'm sure no one's asked you for it. Can I please have it? It's called Dead Boy Detectives. And DC was like, no. And I was like, okay, thanks. And then there was a little bit of a changing of the guard at DC. And I thought, oh, maybe this is my moment while the dust is still up and no one's paying attention. So I snuck in again and asked. And Jim Lee heard about it and talked to Neil. And Neil's great because what he said to me about Dead Boys is these are characters that he created, but he really loves when other creators take these characters in particular, like Jill Thompson took them and turned them into a manga where they're in an all girls school, like pretending to be girls, like bosom buddies style. And like, so like people take it and do something different with it. And so he encouraged me to be as wild and crazy as I wanted to be, which I think we did, but I knew it was important to hang on to the friendship between the boys. I knew it was important to hang on to their relationship with death, which is running from her. And I felt like it was really, really important to maintain their backstories. And on top of that, we just tried to create basically the Hardy Boys on acid. I feel like we did a pretty good job.
Description of, yeah. Mm-hmm. There are some queer elements. I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't seen it yet. I don't know how much of that comes from the comics. How much of that was your invention?
I think I've definitely put a layer of queerness. I mean, and it's a super inclusive show, just in across the board in terms of representation on all levels. So, but it's a very queer show. There are gay characters. There are queer characters. There's a pansexual cat. I mean, there's a pansexual predatory cat. So, we just tried to include as much fun as we could, and I feel like, really happy with the result.
So while you're promoting this, you mentioned you're in Atlanta right now opening a play. You've got plays in production in four different cities right now.
There's a couple going on. Some of them are published, so I don't know about the productions. They're, I just kind of get a check at some point. But this was a relatively new play that we just opened here, closed in LA and then opened here. I try and keep the playwriting side alive all the time because I feel like I write plays for myself. Like I write TV and film for an audience, like for other people, and I write plays for me or else I would go insane. So my plays tend to be darker than what I write for television and a little wilder in terms of spectacle, which if you've seen Flight Attendant, you might be like, how could you be darker and more wild than that? But you can, and I do.
Were you always a writer of plays?
No.
Did you put on little shows in your...
I wrote poetry when I was in middle school and high school and like won little awards and stuff. And if you go back and read them now, well, I would never let you do that. Like, but if I went, I went back and found some old ones and they were just terrible, like striving for importance and meaning. But I never thought I was allowed to be a playwright. I didn't think that was my, I thought that was something that other people got to do, which then carried with me to writing television. I waited to do that because I thought it was something other people got to do. And then it followed me to movies. So lesson I keep learning over and over again.
What was your coming out experience?
I think I knew from a young age. I mean, look, my mom made me learn the Bette Midler songbook on piano. So like, I'm not blaming her, but I'm just saying there's some culpability there. No, she'd kill me if I said
nurture. Yeah. But
I do think that, you know, I was growing up in East Cobb County, is a very wealthy sort of enclave north of Atlanta. And it's where Newt Gingrich came from over and over and over again, if you remember good old Newt. And so I think I knew probably in middle school that I was gay, but I did not come out until I went to college because it just didn't feel like that was going to work in my home environment, especially in the mid 90s. And also there was that kind of weird fear that existed in the mid 90s, that like wrap it up or die kind of the hangover from HIV crisis. And I just feel like there were so many things about being gay that I just didn't understand. And then I went to college and was like, oh wait, okay, here it is. So I came out to my mom in the cafeteria at IKEA.
Wow.
Over like Swedish meatballs. I mean, it's not that. I just like was sitting across from her and I was like, I have such a close relationship with my mama. She's fantastic. And my dad was worked a lot when I was young and then on the weekends played golf and found everything to do except be at home with us. So I felt she raised me and I just was looking at her. She said something about, when are you going to find a girlfriend? Or I can't remember because she wouldn't have put that pressure on me. Like she's cooler than that, but she alluded to like finding someone to date because she didn't want me to be lonely. And I just said it before I knew that I said it. And she cried a little bit, but was cool. It was very cool. And then I had to like come out to my dad three times because the first two times it didn't take.
So how that explain.
I said it to him and he was like, then like a year later, because I just don't talk, our family's very, it's like three people who live in a house. I mean, we go on vacations together and, you know, it's sort of a little bit Southern waspy. And so don't really talk about relationship stuff, but I mentioned something and my dad was like, well, what do you mean? And I was like, well, I'm dating this guy. And he's like, what, you know, Steven, I thought that was just a phase. And I thought you were going to, you know, I thought that was going to, you know, and I was like, no, this is no. Okay. Let's do this again. And so we did it again. And then the next time I realized it didn't stick was when I had a play opening in Atlanta, my first kind of big play called Octopus that has tons of gay thematics in it and a foursome on stage. And so the Atlanta Journal and Constitution was running an article that was like, gay playwright Steve Yockey makes homecoming or something. So I was like, told my dad, and they were like, well, do they have to say that you're gay? And I was like, well, yeah, because it's a gay play and I'm gay also. And I was like, if there's people you haven't told or if you've been trying to pretend it's not real, it's going to be in print like on Friday. So it's time to start calling your friends or whatever. But he's great now. They're both fantastic now. They've both kind of gone through their different journeys of you know, come to terms with it. And they're both very supportive now.
I'm always surprised when a parent like doesn't know that you're absolutely sure before you tell them. You know what I mean? Like, would you seriously have this conversation over Swedish meatballs or, you know, or whatever with either parent if you weren't 100% sure? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, especially in my dad was the disciplinarian. It was very much like, you know, I dealt with my mom almost exclusively unless I did something wrong. And then it was like when your father gets home, and then it was like when dad got home, you know, here comes the trouble. Mm-hmm. So telling my mom, even though it happened unexpectedly, she knew it. And she wished, and, you know, she wished that I had told her sooner, because she always talks about what a happy child I was and that something changed in middle school. And the thing that changed is I realized I was gay and I had to start lying to everyone. And that doesn't feel good. And it's scary. And it has all these components. And you feel like you're walking on eggshells. If every conversation you have with your parents, you're hiding. You know, that's the point when you learn how to be two people, which all gay men and women learn how to do at some point in their lives, in their early lives. So she's like, is this why you became withdrawn in middle school and high school? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, I wish you would have felt like you could talk to me. And I was like, I appreciate that, but I had to figure things out for myself before I was ready to figure them out with you.
Yeah, that's what that poetry was for.
I mean, probably. I remember when I was in sixth grade, I wrote my first poem, and it was in English class. And I'll never forget the teacher, Miss Knopf, she made us read, what's it called? Richard Cory. It's the poem about the guy that's like, he walks on streets of gold. And like, it's a man who everybody thinks has everything. And then at the end of the poem, he shoots himself. And you're like, oh. And so I went home and sort of mimicked that, right? We were supposed to write a poem. So I mimicked that structure, but I made myself like the character. And like, okay. And then sort of the second half of the poem was people at my funeral or whatever. And then I turned it in. And then the next day, I got called to the principal's office, and I walked in, and Miss Knopf was there with my parents, and my mom was crying, and my dad was, and they were concerned about the poem that I had written. And I was like, I mean, if I could look back now, I'd be like, whoa, this is the tip of the iceberg, you guys. Like, you get ready for everything that I'm going to write in my lifetime. But like, it was that moment where you're like, oh, I don't trust my teachers, because there was no conversation. There was no reaching out. But it all got resolved, and, you know, eventually I convinced my parents that I wasn't a danger to myself. But yeah, it was a very strange thing. But I kept writing poems. I just didn't write any more like that.
Sure, sure. Or you kept them to yourself. Miss Knopf cannot have access.
Yeah, absolutely. No more.
Lord, I wonder if Miss Knopf watched The Flight Attendant.
I don't know. I hope wherever she is, she's happy.
I hope so too. Is your family, are they fans of your work?
Yeah. I mean, it took my parents, listen, when you first start writing plays, in particular, when you first start writing plays, you don't really understand. I won't speak for everyone. The majority of young playwrights haven't learned how to work with dramatic action yet. And they don't understand how to build events and obstacles and kind of build to a climax and all that good stuff that you learn through doing. And so everybody that when they're young, they kind of write their first play as about someone who kills themselves or a dead kid or something that comes with like built in, the audience is going to feel this because we haven't learned yet how to do it the more successful way. And so lots of the stuff that I wrote that they first had to come and see at like small theaters and 10-minute play festivals and stuff, it'd be like, there's a theater here in Atlanta called Dad's Garage that gave me an opportunity to write a bunch of 10-minute plays because every year they would have a shorts festival, and it's a comedy theater. So it was like, ha ha, first play, ha ha, second play, ha ha, third play, oh my God, fourth play, ha ha, ha ha, ha ha, for the rest of the night. And I became known in Atlanta as that the kid that wrote the oh my God play, like the play that was going to be about erotic asphyxiation, or the play that was going to be about prostitution gone wrong, or like all these kind of like any kind of crazy dark thing that I wanted to write, people getting in a bloody fight at a punk concert. And so I eventually learned how to kind of temper that with actual craft. But I think it was hard for them at first. I think they like it now. My mom really got into the play stuff. My dad was like, this is not how you make a living. And now because I'm doing well in TV. He's very happy.
Will they call after they've seen an episode with feedback, notes, pitches?
Not notes. No. Although my mom did read one of my plays once and she's like, I have some thoughts about this character. And I was like, okay, well, you're allowed to have them, but I don't have to. I don't have to take them in. That's fine.
Yeah.
No, they're super supportive. They'll fly around the country to see plays if it's something they haven't seen before or something that's not going to be here in Atlanta. So yeah, I think they really get a kick out of it now and kind of going like, what did he do this time? Mm-hmm. I do have a play where the woman explains how to make a coconut cake. And I gave in the play, she describes my mom's coconut cake recipe, which was my grandma's coconut cake recipe. And my mom, when she saw the play, was furious that I put her coconut cake recipe on blast. And I was like, how different could it be? And she's like, that's not the point, Stephen. I didn't teach you how to make that cake so that you could tell the world. And I was like, oh, goodness. So I'm a little more careful.
Yeah. Oh, you got to be careful with the coconut cake.
Apparently.
Wow. So with all of the work and travel and whatnot, are you seeing anyone?
I am so single right now.
Okay.
I wish that I could tell you that I had like a loving partner at home supporting me, but I don't have that. I have a great dog, Barnaby, that my friend Ryan takes care of whenever I'm out of town because I travel quite a bit. Barnaby's my man.
Okay. What kind of dog is Barnaby?
He is a multi-poo,
uh-huh.
if I had to guess.
Okay.
And I raised him, so he is selfish and spoiled and thinks that he runs the house. So that's my fault. I can't say no to the dog.
How could you? What were your early dating experiences like?
I think all through my 20s, I wasn't very good at dating because I still didn't know who I was. You know, I mean, I think in a pretty extreme way, I was still like wrestling with all kinds of things about myself. That didn't have to do with being gay. They just had to do with like, I don't know what I want my life to be. Am I really going to be a writer? Am I even good at this? Like, what am I doing? Eating ramen every day, telling people I'm a playwright when I don't have plays produced. I don't know what this is. So I think most of those weren't relationships so much as like hooking up in my 20s, just kind of like some type of connection enough to like get me through to the next time that I hooked up with someone. I think in my 30s, I kind of got more comfortable in my skin and started really dating. And it took me a while to realize that on your first date, you don't have to tell your life story, including every horrible thing that's ever happened. That can be somewhat off-putting. But once I got over that obstacle, I had a couple of really meaningful relationships that I'm happy I got to experience.
Who in Dallas set your type for life? Were you a Bobby?
I mean, I was going to say Bobby, right? Like,
yeah.
But I also think in a weird way, just based on a lot of the men that I've dated, Stu Ellen still dated.
Wow.
I hate to bring it back to Sue Ellen Ewing, but like I love, unfortunately, I'm attracted to people that need help. So, you know, that's something I'm working on.
Wow. I mean, in that case, we both got 18,000 people we can set you up with.
That's great. I look forward to the list.
Yeah, the DMs are about to blow up with all of our broken listeners.
Mm-hmm. Our most broken listeners. Who are
I didn't say broken. I said need some help. I didn't say
okay.
broken.
That's okay.
Right. You said that.
We did put that word in
okay,
your mouth.
That's fair.
Very sorry. And you should slap us with a martini in
but
your
I
hand.
Will say, like, right. I recently got out of, I mean, I dated a guy for 6 months and that relationship was fantastic. And then it was that thing where, you know, the reason that you date people is you find out, hey, is this, like, you date people to find out if it's going to work together. Like, yes, we like each other. Yes, we're attracted to each other, but is this going to work? And it just didn't work. But like, I wouldn't trade those 6 months for anything. Like, it was a great experience. So I do feel like there's something about getting older where you can, you know, every breakup isn't like, oh, it's like, I'm glad that happened. I'm glad that the breakup happened, but I'm glad that I had that experience and I'll take that into next time, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Which feels a lot better than like in my 20s, someone would break up and I'd be like, oh, like Lear on the Heath, rending my garments, like, you know, just like shouting into the storm. And when you dated someone for like 2 weeks. So yeah, I've grown a bit since then. A bit.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I mean, that early stuff is fun in its way, but it's also, you know, it takes years off your life.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some, look, we went through a global pandemic. It certainly adjusted my perspective on things a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the truth. Did you get it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've had it three times.
Okay.
Two times was like, one time I didn't even know I had it. I just had the antibodies, which means I had it at some point. So that was a blessing. One time I had it a little, like I had it, but it just mild. And then one time I had the knockdown drag out, like you're on your ass version of it. And that was not pleasant.
No, we don't love that.
Have you had it?
I have, just the once. Matt?
Just the once?
Just the once.
One time.
On my honeymoon.
Oh no.
At the end. I mean, I say that for dramatic effect, but truthfully, it was like on the way home where we were both like, oh shit. Better to get it then than before the wedding or before the honeymoon. So I'll take it.
Yeah, at the end of the honeymoon is a good time to get it, but still, or just not get it at all. That would have been cool.
That would have been real nice. I'll just say this. I got it from New Kids on the Block. I was doing a video for their socials for the beginning of their mixtape tour. And it was their tour started in Cincinnati at a massive arena. And the big feature of this massive arena apparently was no ventilation at all. And so it was packed in with a whole bunch of New Kids on the Block and Rick Astley and Salt-N-Pepa and Vogue fans screaming disease into my mouth. And I got it from them, and it was bad, but I'll take it.
What an iconic way to get it though.
I
got it on a plane. You got it at New Kids on the Block, man.
Yeah. Worth it. I mean, I've got bragging rights, I figure. Anyway, Stephen, best of luck with Dead Boy Detectives. Sorry.
Okay.
And Stephen, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, you guys. This was a total pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
And safe travels. I mean, nothing fly off of your plane.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears. I hope nothing flies off the plane. I'm sure you'll hear about it if it does happen. So
good.
Yeah. Come back and tell us all about it.
Yes, please. Dish.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
That is our show. Please do give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Instagram at HomophiliaPod. Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, music by Ben Wise. Our executive producer is Renee Colvert. Our associate producer is Jess Walensky, and our audio engineer is Justin Mattson. Many thanks to Michael Pressman and everyone at World of Wonder.